So I'm here today with Lily Analek talking about her fantastic piece in the new issue of Airmail, American Gigolo, an oral history on the 40th anniversary of the film. And Lily, welcome.
Thank you for having me, Michael.
Great. So as we said, American Gigolo comes out 4 decades ago. And yet it's one of those films that still endures in the culture. So I think, like a lot of people, I'm wondering how and kind of why it has such staying power.
I think it's one of those movies that defies rational explanation. I think Casablanca is like this too. I don't think you can make a case for it as a great movie rationally, logically, yet it's a great movie, you know? I can watch it endlessly, but its greatness is not connected to plot. You know, it's the plot is kind of a conventional murder mystery. Its greatness is the intangibles. It's kind of its mood, its atmosphere, its look. I think American Gigolo has this seductive suck to it. There's this kind of half gorgeous, kind of half repellent feeling that's totally entrancing to me. And no matter how many times I watch the movie, when I watch it again, I fall right back into it. And there's another thing. The movie is released in 1980, but it's really kind of a late 70s movie. And you can kind of feel its kind of cokey rhythms, and it's kind of got this gay paranoia in it, and you can feel disco, and you can feel the end of disco. And I think in that scene with Richard Gere dressing, you can feel MTV coming. You know, MTV would come in 1982, and I think you can feel AIDS coming in it. It's amazing, and it's kind of one of the great L.A. movies, and it's, you know, L.A. is this city that's about lifestyle, and it's about kind of the fantasy of living like you're a movie star, even if you're not a movie star, and Gigolo somehow conveys all of that.
It's also fascinating. I mean, you know, I was thinking about it, it's, spoiler alert here, but it's a noir movie, bad things happen in it, and yet it has a happy ending.
Oh, I know.
Which, not many noirs, I mean, in a traditional noir, he'd be going to the electric chair and she'd be, you know, standing there in the visitor's cell waiting, you know, watching him go out the door. But this is, what do you make of the ending?
Well, I guess I sort of don't pay attention to the ending in the same way I don't pay attention to the sexual chemistry that is supposedly exists between Gere and Hutton. I mean, it seems like a gay movie to me and it seems like a sad movie to me. And somehow that's what you take, for me, that's what you take away from the movie. I feel like if I had asked you, I know, Michael, we were talking before and you watched the movie 2 days ago, but I bet if I asked you 3 days ago if the movie had a happy ending, you would not have thought it did.
No, you just sort of imagine in your mind.
Yeah,
that
you
it
do.
Doesn't.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
And yet, you know, it's bleak, 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 dark, dark, dark. You know, underworld, underworld, underworld.
Absolutely.
You know, subculture. You know, it's coming off of that 70s run of movies that were responding to the bleak period in the culture or influenced by it. But here it comes around to, like Schrader say, it's like a Hollywood movie at that point.
You know? Well, I think you can't forget that Jerry Bruckheimer produced this movie.
Yeah.
So the 80s are coming. But I guess when I was saying that the plot of the movie is a conventional murder mystery, but that's not the movie. I feel like everything about this movie is subtextual, and the gayness and the darkness and the bleakness and the direness, that's what actually comes through. That's what makes the movie great. It's all the subtextual stuff in the movie that you remember, I think.
Yeah, which is interesting because it's so much about appearances and surfaces as we talk about that art direction, right?
You're right.
And yet, it's everything that's underneath it and behind it. And
that's right.
It's that reminder that everything is glossy and beautiful in these worlds, and yet there's a seediness which is L.A. in many ways. People always say, right, it just looks like paradise, but it's, you know, it's seedy and falling apart in many ways.
Well, yeah. I mean, I just think that's the contradiction of the city. It's a city that looks like paradise, and people come there with all kinds of optimism and hope, you know, making it in the movies, becoming a star, and it works out for almost nobody. So there's this kind of undercurrent of despair and darkness and kind of a haunted mood.
Yeah.
And that movie, I think Gigolo gets that, you know, better than just about any other movie except maybe Mulholland Drive. You know, that despair, that hardcore despair under the surface.
Yeah, and where everything is, it takes that view of L.A. that I think you can always have, which is, it's such a transactional town.
Oh, yeah.
Right, and, you know, which is why I love Moroder calls it his crack at the song Man Machine, you know. And there's that line where Lauren Hutton and Gear and he starts to sort of try and get it on with her, and she stops him and she says to him, you know, like, you sort of, I can feel you going to work when you want to have sex with me, right?
Yeah.
And it's just, it's, he can't help himself. He is, it's transactional. Everyone in that town is transactional.
Yeah.
From the senator on, you know, all across. And it's just, Schrader sets up love as this most transactional of all things. And at the end, it's so redemptive. Right? it's cue the strings and let them swell. And,
Oh, no, she'd have let him rot in that cell. She'd have gone off with her husband, of course. I mean, the emotional logic is so strong, you just know that that would happen. And he kind of took the ending of the Brassens movie, Pickpocket, and just superimposed it kind of on Gigolo. I mean, Schrader's open about that. He took the ending of Pickpocket.
Yeah.
But it's just, L.A. is not a spiritual town in that way. It just, well, and I think it's also interesting, you know, Lauren Hutton actually talks about this, that there's no... You never see them have sex, really, or even kiss. I mean, there's that weird montage where you see kind of body parts. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
But it's an incredibly odd, fragmented sex scene. You never see them sexually connect.
No, it's a weird... It's because it's also this sort of strange music video-ish early stage, like, where Gear comes up and you briefly see, you know, Lauren's, unless it's a body double torso.
Yeah.
You know, and then his hands cupping her. And you're like, this is just like a bad East German film right now. And then it swings back into, and the only nudity you get in the film is Gear.
Of course.
You know, which again is, I think, was a total shock. If you would tell people, there's a scene where he's standing full frontal, backle, sidle, nude for a good 40 seconds.
Yeah.
I don't know. When it comes up and you see it again, you're like, wait, this got through the censors? In 1980?
I know, it's amazing. It's amazing. Well, I mean, it's just the case for the movie as, you know, a very gay movie. I mean, it is. It's so infatuated with him. I think it would have been, you know, Meryl Streep kind of found the movie distasteful and wouldn't do it. And we know that Julie Christie dropped out when John Travolta was involved with it. I mean, I think it's a very tough role for a woman because the movie has no interest in her.
So Meryl Streep was offered the part as well.
Yeah, I mean, Meryl Streep was also offered the part. And I'd never heard that Mia Farrow kind of was in contention for this movie. And it's sort of fascinating to imagine her in that part.
Yeah.
Because I actually find Lauren Hutton quite maternal in that role. And I know Mia Farrow has many children, but I don't see her as that kind of figure. So I wonder how she and Richard Gere would have kind of bounced off of each other in that movie.
Yeah,
because she's so delicate and kind of girlish.
And as well, Streep, you know, which I think what she was probably coming off Deer Hunter at that point, and that's 78, 79. And I mean, she's peak beauty then, but you can't.
No. She'd have eaten him alive.
Yeah.
No. And I don't see her as having patience with him. Lauren Hutton is kind of really great with him, I think.
Yeah.
It's hard for me to picture other people in those roles, even though kind of famously they were all supposed to be played by different people. And one of the things that Schrader said that I thought was really fascinating was when John Travolta to me is a warmer actor than Gere. I mean, Gere is just kind of immaculately narcissistic, and that's why he's so effective in that role. And John Travolta just has a warmth to him.
Yeah.
And I think more of a sense of humor. I can't imagine how Schrader would have directed him. And Schrader kind of scoffed when I said, would you have directed him warmer? And he said, directing that character warm would be like giving Travis Bickle a dog. You know, it's a cold movie.
Yeah. Gere has such a blankness to his face. I think that's why he works in the role. It's just, you know, whereas I see what you're saying with Travolta, he's got his eyes are more alive.
Alive eyes.
Yeah.
I always think of him, and he's so great in Saturday Night Fever, but there's panic. They get panicked. They worry.
Yeah. And you can see in Saturday Night Fever, like, moments when he's needing, his sadness, he's got sadness in his eyes at those points, and where he can feel caught between worlds, right?
And he'd want to connect, and that character cannot connect.
No. He's a man machine.
all true.
Yeah. What other surprises do you think, when you look at the film, come for you?
Well, yeah, I know a couple of stories kind of jumped out of me. A couple of stories jumped out at me. And Richard Gere's clothes in this movie are kind of famously designed by Giorgio Armani. And Giorgio Armani back in the late 70s, early 80s was not Giorgio Armani. You know, he was, I'm sure, a promising up-and-comer, but he was not like a household name. And Gigolo is the making of Armani because Richard Gere wears the clothes so well. I mean, you can almost say the clothes are wearing Richard Gere in that movie. And Giorgio Armani becomes kind of famous from this movie, and there's this kind of great urban legend. I mean, it might be true, it might just be a rumor, but it's persistent. You know, it's to this day that Richard Gere can go into any Armani store anywhere in the world and walk out with whatever he wants without paying, you know, and it's Armani, I guess, was so grateful to him, so grateful to Gigolo, you know, that he can have whatever he wants. And I don't know if it's baloney. I don't know if it's true or not, but it should be true,
right,
you know, because,
right.
because I mean, it was the making of Armani.
Yeah. What, when you talk about the Besson movie, tell me a little bit more about that, that which Schrader grafted onto the end for himself.
Yeah, I mean, Schrader as well for Besson. I'm probably murdering that, you know, like any good American. I cannot pronounce French words. I think it's Bresson, but he loved the pickpocket, and he just took the ending from the pickpocket and grafted it onto American Gigolo. And, you know, when I was writing this piece, of course, I watched the pickpocket. I mean, it's kind of shot for shot. It's the same ending. It's the identical ending. And I guess, I mean, we're having this conversation. We don't really think it's organic to the movie, but somehow kind of the spirit or the mood of the movie is so strong, it overwhelms all the externals. It overwhelms plot.
Yeah.
The mood is that dominant.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, kind of another story that was just kind of knocked me out was I interviewed Paul Jasmin for this piece, and Paul Jasmin did the poster for American Gigolo. He was operating off of a photograph that a woman had taken named Jean Pugliasi. I don't know how to say her last name. Anyway, it's a great photograph, but he made it into a poster, and it's a killer poster. And I'd say that the poster for American Gigolo is as important as Giorgio Moroder's soundtrack or Debbie Harry's theme song or Giorgio Armani's clothes. It just gets the movie. Paul Jasmin is gay, and Paul Jasmin was very close to Nando Scarfiotti. Scarfiotti is the Italian who'd worked with Bertolucci, and he kind of designed the entire look of Gigolo. And Paul Schrader was very much in the gay world at that time during Gigolo, and he'd kind of, he was captivated by it and under its spell, and he was living in it, you know, to some extent. And there was the story that Paul Jasmin told me that, you know, it was late at night. He and Paul Schrader were in a hot tub together, and there's a lot of cocaine around. And Paul Schrader has a loaded gun next to the hot tub. And at one point, he takes out the gun, and he starts playing Russian roulette with it. You know, he's got the gun presumably in his mouth, and he's pulling the trigger. And Paul Jasmin said that there was this kind of very kind of strange, kind of repressed gay charge in the air. And that Paul was doing this. And, you know, Paul Schrader is great because he's, you know, he's really honest. You know, I asked him about this, and he just said, yeah, you know, if I was going to kind of do the gay thing, I would have done it with Paul Jasmin, but I didn't. And he said, and, you know, I was really kind of cheating at that. In my memory, I was cheating at that game of Russian roulette. I'd kind of checked the cylinders. I knew where the bullet was, but it's obviously an insane thing to do, you know, to be squeezing that trigger. So a psychiatrist got called in, and it was Paul's psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist, you know, convinced Paul to give him his gun, and that was the end of it. But Paul Schrader was telling me that, you know, 30-odd years later, he was in Los Angeles, and he got curious, and he looked up the psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist was still in his office on Pico Boulevard, and he went to see him, and he said to the guy, he said, I don't know if you remember, but, and he tells the whole story, the Russian roulette, the loaded gun, and the psychiatrist opens his desk drawer, and he pulls out the gun, and he says, you know, I keep this with me always because it reminds me of why I do what I do, which is great, you know. And Schrader actually tried to talk the psychiatrist into giving him back the gun, but the psychiatrist would not.
Yeah, it's it's what you think of L.A. in the 70s as, you know, I mean.
Easy Riders, Raging Bulls, right?
Yeah, and Easy Riders, Raging Bulls, and Russian Roulette in hot tubs, you know, it's, why not? You know, it's like Boogie Nights all over, right?
Yeah, it is like Boogie Nights all over. And the cocaine. I mean, you can't forget the cocaine, which has made everyone more paranoid and jacked up and sexed out.
Yeah. As well, and the cocaine, which figures in the movie, is, as I think Paul says about that dress, the montage of John laying, Richard laying on his clothes. But you know, there's a brief moment where like he does a hit of cocaine just to like to get dressed. Like it's just like this is gonna be fun. Like it's like opens up his closets and like let's get the party going on my bed with the clothes.
I know, when I'm alone. It's right? Amazing. Yeah. It does have that kind of, I guess, religious, I shouldn't say religious experience, but it does. Like he pulls open the drawer.
No, it's all the,
and the
it's
music
all
the, soars.
Right, it's all the objects, but you exactly used the right word a while ago, which fetishization of it all, right? But it's just, and he's just, I mean, he's caressing those pieces more than he caresses a woman's body in those scenes, right? To go back to what you were saying about the sort of clumsiness with which you see him actually like touch Lauren's body, yet with these, when he's laying out these,
so tender,
you know, these clothes, and like on laying them down on the bed, these looks, you know, like it's just here you go, let me lay you down on my mattress, right?
You're right, I forgot, like, it was on his bed.
Yeah, lay Lady Armani across my bed.
Yeah, no, right. That's very funny. And, you know, Paul also says that, I mean, this is not in the piece, but, you know, there's like kind of a sequel to Gigolo?
No.
Yeah, it's called The Walker. And it stars Woody Harrelson. And I guess it was a bad experience for everybody. I did a cover story on Woody Harrelson for Esquire and asked him about the movie. And it was a miserable experience for him. But Schrader kind of explained it to me that, you know, he wondered what would Richard Gere's character, what would Julian Kay be doing 20, 30 years later? And he feels he would be out of the closet. Uh-huh. And, you know, he'd be a walker, you know, which, you know the term walker.
Sure, sure.
Yeah. It had to get explained to me, but it's a gay man who kind of escorts rich or famous women to events, you know?
The most famous example might be Truman Capote in the 60s, right?
Where sure.
You've got Bill Buckley's wife, and you know, and you've got all these charity events, and he's who does one, like he's the guy who accompanies the glamorous woman around to social events, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So. And Paul Jasmine actually used to do that for Judy Garland.
Right.
So yeah, it's a long and honorable tradition, but that's what Paul Schrader imagined. That's where he imagined Julian Kay would be. He would be a walker.
Yeah.
Just kind of great.
Well,
which
you can see, because there's moments in the film where he's basically already with these aged women. You know, that scene at the antique place, right? Where it's just,
that scene is wild when Richard Gere is pretending to be gay. Wolf. It's so awkward.
Like,
I know.
Pretending to be what he thinks, what someone in the late 70s would imagine a gay decorator to be like.
Yeah, right?
And he just, you know, goes into whatever that voice and mannerism are.
It's incredibly awkward. But yeah, he's really taking these women around, you know, shopping or to events.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem like it's a sex thing.
No. And they're probably women who are realistically in their mid to late 50s, yet look older.
Yeah. You know? Oh, yeah, yeah. Candace Bergen's mom's one of them.
Is she the...
She's,
the woman
from Out of Town, I
yes,
think. Yeah.
Yeah,
that's her.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, nowadays these women, you know, nobody would look at them as so kind of put out to pasture, but back then,
yeah,
for sure. But yeah, it always has more of a walker feel to it.
Yeah, that's
you know,
funny.
It is.
I just do you have a favorite scene in the film?
Yeah, besides the wardrobe scene.
Besides the wardrobe.
Oh, what else do I really love? I love the opening scene. This, you know, just along the PCH.
Yeah.
I love the feel of it. He's in that trance. He's in that L.A. trance, driving on the freeway and in the sun and having some kind of fantasy about who he is. I love it.
Yeah.
And I think Nina Van Pallant is good in it. I really wanted to find her. Nina Van Pelt, like, say, another L.A. movie I love is The Long Goodbye, you know, the Robert Altman movie. And she's so great in that. And she was involved in the Clifford Irving scandal, you know, the Howard Hughes.
Right.
She was dating Clifford Irving at the time. And she started out as part of some kind of musical group in Sweden or Denmark. And
Not ABBA.
No, something else. But everything about her is kind of slightly kind of classy, seedy, like aristocratic, seedy. But she's unfindable. I could not find her.
Wow.
I know. She's still alive.
Yeah. I love this scene. And you touched on your thing, but I love the scene of when Gere first sees Hutton in the polo bar at the Beverly Hills Hotel.
Yeah.
I just think it's, I mean, it's visually stunning. And I think, you know, watching these two cats, you know, you know, literally like look at each other and sort of, and the game they're going to play. And I think Hutton looks fantastic. And the thing about the glow and, you know, just, there's a tension between the two of them and a chemistry. And, you know, you wonder, it made me also wonder what were the scenes that Paul Schrader was running between Farrow and Travolta? Was it that scene? Like, what scene do you test? Because
it would have to be that one. You're right.
Yeah.
It's funny because, you know, those scenes are charged, but I don't think it's sexual tension. I always feel like there's this slightly skewed or off quality to their interactions, and that's what gives them their tension and fascination. And I think it's that she knows, you know, when she tells him to stop, when they're about to have sex and she says, you're going to work, I always feel like she's almost telling him it's okay, you know?
Right.
She's almost outing him. And those scenes where he goes into the disco, I think it's Pulse, which was a real nightclub, a real gay nightclub in Hollywood at the time. And he seems so frightened and panicked. Do you know what I'm talking about? There's something about how the emotion, the words in the scene and the emotion don't quite match up. And I think it's what gives everything its like compulsive quality, because you can't quite figure out what's going on.
Yeah. Yeah. He's, I'm thinking too about the scene where you're exactly right. She's trying to give him permission and he won't take it.
And he won't take it. And he never does. And I think there's also like I loved Bill Duke in the movie, and Bill Duke plays Leon. So there's two pimps. The first pimp is Nina Van Pallant, who's kind of his classy pimp. And then he has kind of a black eye pimp, Bill Duke is kind of, he's gay in the movie. He's sleeping with men, but he's very macho and has kind of a surly, nasty quality, and he completely dominates Julian. And it seems like he kind of sexually terrorizes him, to me too.
Right.
And when I was talking or kind of interviewing Bill Duke, and Bill Duke always calls Julian's character Julie, just totally emasculating. So the movie has kind of all those things. And you never know who Julian is, how he got into this business. A couple of his tricks, you know, a couple of his women clients will ask him questions about his background, and he'll always give a slightly different story. So you know it's bullshit. You know it's not true. So there's just this sense you don't know who this guy is, where he comes from, why he's doing this, what he actually wants or desires, what his end game is. You don't know any of these things.
Yeah, well, it's the cipherness of him. And so I say it's, you know, it's sort of like so much in L.A. where everything is below the surface and the stories are just invented, right?
Yeah.
It's sort of like you change your name and you change where you come from.
Your backstory.
And, you know, it's all.
It is. I find that kind of the most interesting thing, and you just touched on it, or we talked about it a little bit, why it's such an LA movie, because it's like it's a movie influenced way of life without any of the people actually being involved in Hollywood in the movie. Nobody in the movie is an actor or producer. Nobody. But it's that movie influenced LA life. It's that you can be a fantasy version of yourself, you know.
And it's that LA life that also is, even if you're not working in the business, you're peripheral, you know, you're making money from the thing that is, it's a company town.
It's a complete company town, but it's also, I think this is like one of the ways that movies influenced our sex lives in ways that you don't notice, but it's getting watched. It's not just voyeurism, but it's like being the object of voyeurism. I mean, Richard Gere seems so turned on by himself, you know, and he's, there's a scene where Lauren Hutton, it's such an odd scene, Lauren Hutton's spying on him and mm-hmm. following him.
Yeah.
And she's so obvious about it, and it seems like her character would never do something this pathetic. But he likes that she's following him and watching him, and she knows that he knows she's watching, and then they go home and have sex. Like, it's, there's something about being watched.
It's such a weirdo scene. I'm glad you brought it up. Because the weirdness of that scene is Lauren Hutton, like, she there's a, it becomes almost like this Annie Hall moment.
Yes.
It's this, she starts to play this quirky girl.
Yeah.
Like when she's got the floppy hat, she's been wearing these beautiful clothes, and all of a sudden she's wearing this floppy hat and, you know, like, and like that kind of pork pie hat down, and like she's in disguise. It's like, are you a dork? Like, what is, and yet, and then like Gears guy's like, they're like, they're two young lovers playing like hide and seek all of a sudden. And you're like, and then they go to the record. It's so awkward and weird. And then it sort of shifts gears into like back into the film. It's just very odd.
Odd. No, everything about totally, you know? Odd interlude. And it's really, he's got the jacket kind of hooked over his shoulder, and his pants are tight, and his shirt is tight. And he's kind of, he checks out his image in every reflective surface. You know, it's just.
Yeah, it's all selfie.
Yeah, it is. But it's like, that's the fantasy, you know?
Yeah.
No, but it's great. I actually feel like the way we're talking about the movie, it sounds bad, yet somehow it all works.
Well, it's not bad. It's just, it's there's moments that you sort of, but it's the moment, I think what we're talking about is it's entirely compelling. And like you, I think it's one of those films, there's so many layers to it, visually, psychologically, culturally, where it is and where it is now. And it's just, I love when you equated it to Casablanca, right?
Because it should work.
People have to remember, like, that was a B movie when it came out.
Yeah. You
know, it with time gained this stature.
But the plot's ridiculous. Like, if you push too hard on it, but somehow it has that movie magic thing. It just works. Yeah. It just works. And it's funny because, like, Schrader, and he said this to me, and I've heard him say it in other interviews, that he feels the movie was cowardly and that it should have been gayer. But that's such a misbegotten take on it, in my opinion. If the movie had been overt, it wouldn't be interesting. It's all that, all the stuff that's going on subtextually, all the tension, all the struggle, all the panic, that's what gives the movie its kind of engine and its drive.
Yeah.
Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, I think it's, I can understand why Schrader would, hindsight, look back and say, I, you know, should have pushed it harder and more overt, right? Well, studio movie in late 70s, early 80s, like, you're not going to be able to do that, right? It's you know, the only precedent maybe at that point is Midnight Cowboy, right?
Right.
But that's, you know, which came out with an X before it came down to an R.
Right.
And I think, you know, the studios, so it's easier, but you're exactly right. You can't push too hard on it, on the suspension of disbelief, because it does fall apart. But yet, the sort of confines that were put on him.
I know.
Actually, it's again, what great movies happen accidentally.
Totally.
You know, and just like you said, the casting is like
the sloppy seconds thing.
It's all of a sudden, it's perfect.
It's perfect. Right? It couldn't have worked out better. No. It's totally. And we didn't even talk about the Palm Springs scene, which has like the scary, nasty.
That's the.
Yeah.
That was Creep Fest.
Creep Fest, where the guy wants Richard to hurt the girl. It's, and the woman never has, it's Judy Ryman, that's the character's name, and she's the one who gets murdered, and Julian is in a frame job for killing her, but she never speaks. It's very weird. She has that long scene with him where he tries to get her calm before he...
And that's when... And again, to go back to the man machine, when he's trying to, quote-unquote, get her calm or...
Get
her aroused. It's his robotic language.
Oh, it's hilarious. You know? I know.
It's almost like a doctorate. Now I'm going to turn you over. Right? And it was,
I know, it's ridiculous.
And you're like, you get paid for this?
He gets paid because he looks good, I guess. But I know. And did he want to be an actor? Did he want to be a movie star?
For sure.
You know?
But that whole interlude, it did remind me of the movie you referenced earlier,
Mulholland.
Mulholland.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because it's so, I don't know, just when, you know, the house, that cold, weird mausoleum like Palm Springs house.
And, oh, yeah.
You know, just, and then there's always that thing in the noir movies, which is not just, you know, as Jasmine, when he shot the poster, as you alluded to, was so smart with the menace of shadows cast by Venetian blinds. But then there's also in the noir, what I always think is like that disconcerting thing of like water, light reflected off of interior pools at night on ceilings.
You know,
This is, here comes the bad part.
No, it's completely spooky. No. And it was even hearing, like, I interviewed a guy named David Freeman, who was a screenwriter and who lived in the apartment that Richard Gere lives in.
Yeah, the apartment complex.
Yeah, and he was explaining to me that there wasn't a person in that apartment complex who was not in the business. You know, it was Terry Garr. It was George Hamilton, Mr. Tan, you know, and it was just, and it's interesting too that that Schrader and it was Scarfiotti's, I believe it was Scarfiotti's location, he picked it, but that it's an LA movie. We've been talking about this in which nobody works in the business, and yet the apartment complex was suffused with Hollywood people, you know? Yeah, so it's just that movie influenced kind of life.
Yeah,
and it was actually, to give credit, it was, I don't know how to say her name, Jean Pugliosi, was that Italian name?
Oh, right.
Who shot the picture. She's the one who actually took that shot of Richard Gere that they use on the poster, and then kind of Paul Jasmine kind of did the coloring and the mood of the photo. He kind of hand-colored it. Yeah. But she was the one who said that when she watched the movie, it had that, the Venetian blinds were kind of a theme. And just as you said, it was kind of psychological undertones and a feeling of unease and a feeling of a person not being straightforward with you about who they are.
Yeah, and interior spaces that are in shadow. So on that note, I just want to say, Lily, thanks for a fantastic piece and thank you for being here. And thank you to everyone for listening to Airmail. We'll see you soon.